Hello, I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
And I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond.
This week, we're chatting about rice, food swaps, and cooking good food on a budget with Leanne Brown, author of Good and Cheap. But first, let's compare notes on something that we read this week. Marisa?
So the big news right at the moment is that Mark Bittman has officially left the New York Times and is a joint... And that's not new news. He had been saying for a while that he was leaving. But the big news is that he's joining Purple Carrot, which is a vegan meal delivery system or service. And these are – it's one of the many meal delivery services that have popped up in the last few years. And if you're not familiar with them, things like Blue Apron or Plated, they bring ingredients to you. So you get a box. It comes with like all the cool packs and all the things are portioned out. And the recipes are there, and so you can make your dinner without a lot of grocery shopping or prep or anything like that.
I actually wrote about these services earlier this year for Women's Health.
Did you?
And I learned kind of a lot about them. Blue Apron, for example, is so much more popular than you would think. They, you know, send millions of meals out. And it never really clicked with me that how they might be useful for people, really, because you still have to do the chopping, you know,
yeah.
You still have to do the taking out your pots and pans. But I know I recently came back from visiting my sister who doesn't have access to a lot of grocery stores, mm-hmm. and she can't really get things like, say, lemongrass or where she lives in rural Virginia. So shortly after I did the story, I sent her a gift so that she could try it. And there is something to be said about that convenience in a certain situation.
Yeah. Did she like it?
I think she did like it, but she lives with a picky spouse and like there might have been – But Purple Carrot is less popular than something like Blue Apron, but they do have that interesting vegan twist. I thought Mark Bittman was an unusual choice because it's not as if he is a vegan. How do you feel about that?
Although he definitely has been beating the drum for a mostly vegan lifestyle for a while, you know, because he does this whole vegan before 6 o'clock thing. Although this seems to be an absolute reverse of that because here they are offering dinners – which is the one meal that you eat after 6 o'clock typically. But I feel like they're looking for someone who has expertise in that and also just
name recognition
and sort of a personality. And he certainly got all of those things. Did you try any of the meal delivery services while you were writing the story?
Let me confess to you, they all wanted to send me them to try.
Uh-huh.
But this story had more of a business angle and you know, the idea that I was writing about was like, how can you steal the strategies from these companies to make it easier for you to cook at home? Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel it was necessary. And I knew that my husband would lose his brain if that box came to our house with all of the little plastic things, all the little, you know, you can't – not every part of the packaging can be recycled. And it's – yeah, it's like kind of an environmental disaster.
Yeah, I could see that really Dan – lose it.
Which is, I'm surprised it doesn't make Mark Bittman lose it because the environment is a big arm of his argument for reforming the food system.
Well, I guess he also is a realist and understands that people need to eat. And so they're going to, you know, just living on this planet, we all have an impact. And
it's
so,
true. But I mean, have you seen one of these boxes?
I have. I was staying at a friend's house once and they had gotten a delivery and it's sort of like all these little individual plastic bottles with sauces and all the cold packs. And I definitely already struggle with packaging and what comes into my life. Just, you know, when I get like review stuff or, you know, people send me jars and they come shrouded in bubble wrap. And it's hard to deal with that stuff on a regular basis. And if you're getting, I feel like, if people were getting large, you know, getting those shipments every week, they'd become sort of numbed to the idea that they were responsible for this packaging.
Hmm. Well, but it will be interesting to see how his role evolves there and what kind of content he's going to bring to the site and the role that will have growing their business. And we'll keep an eye on it.
It's true. Just one more thing. Somebody pointed out to me recently that they feel like grocery stores should get in the business of doing these meals.
So I think, well, I don't know. I think some are.
Yeah.
I know Fresh Direct does something like this. And I think some grocery stores are.
Yeah.
But obviously the grocery shopping landscape is changing so much.
I think it's going to be really interesting because I do feel like these kits are the wave of the future as people are busier and busier. But Who knows?
Maybe we'll get to the point like in the olden days with the milkman where your milk came in to your door in a glass jar and then he took the glass jar back. Yeah. Like something like that, I would feel way better about.
That'd be nice. But anyway.
Let's talk about what we're making for dinner. All it's right. probably not coming out of those little boxes.
No.
We're into cooking rice lately.
Yeah.
So give me your rice manifesto.
I'm a brown rice person, although in recent years there's been all this scare about mercury in rice mm-hmm. because the brown rice is less refined, so it absorbs more. I don't know. I can't worry about that too much. But I do love rice. Growing up, we ate a lot of brown rice in my household, and it was just something my mom always cooked on the stovetop. No big deal. I have always done the same. In recent years, I haven't eaten as much rice because everybody was like, oh, carbs are bad kind of a thing, and I got swept up in that. But I've returned to rice because I feel like it's easy, it's inexpensive, it rounds out a meal really well, and I love what the leftovers can do.
Like, what are some examples of your leftover rice?
Certainly I'll make like a big veggie stuffed fried rice with, you know, carrots and celery and onions and lots of kale or Swiss chard or whatever.
With brown rice?
With brown rice. Yeah. The leftover brown rice makes a great fried rice. One of the things I learned from my Hawaiian relatives is a fried egg on top of some rice, which is the most delicious thing in the whole world, with some pickled ginger on the side. And then also I love having like a cup of fried rice or just regular leftover rice in the fridge for when I make a pot of soup so that I can just dump a little rice, bulk it up a little bit and, make it feel more filling.
I also make brown rice. I make white rice more often as a complement to a stir fry, for example, but I do also love brown rice, but I always make it in the stove. I feel like it's good even heat. I bake it and it just turns out
more. You bake it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I bring some water to a boil, put the rice and salt in. I do it in like a smallish Le Creuset and then a low oven for an hour.
Wow.
And then you let it stand for a while. And for me, it's more foolproof cooking. I have not had great success with brown rice on the stove. But I don't love brown rice in a stir fry.
Really?
I like brown rice added to a salad, warm or cold. Mm-hmm. I love it with any kind of like a Japanese dressing, like a carrot ginger dressing or miso dressing. But sometimes I make rice, like little savory pancakes with rice and egg and veg. Brown rice is good in that way.
Yeah.
But I'm more of a long grain white rice gal.
Which is also good. But yeah, I've always been, you know, just growing up, my hippie mother, brown rice was the thing. It's funny too, because recently someone sent me a rice cooker. So the Tiger people sent me one of their rice cookers to be like, hey, let us show you what a rice cooker can do. And I have to say, I'm kind of converted. I really like it, in part because you can set a timer. So like you can, you know, set it to go overnight or something. I also like it because it's been amazing for cooking things like quinoa. Because it doesn't really discriminate too much. It'll cook whatever's in it until the water is dissolved.
Yeah, and it's foolproof every time, right?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing.
I'm a little bit challenged when it comes to rice. I can basically only make perfect rice on my own stove with one cup of rice. if I try to vary the quantity or the heat level, like, you know how I have induction and my induction goes really low. So if I add the amount of water that a typical rice recipe would call for, the water does not get absorbed. So for one cup of rice, I use approximately 1 1/4 cups water.
Oh, wow.
And I think it's the low, low heat. But if I tried to do that on your stove, it would probably totally scorch.
Yeah.
Do you have a ratio that you use?
For brown rice, I typically do 2-to-1. So I'll do 2 parts water, 1 part rice, a little less when I'm cooking white rice. And if I'm doing like something that I want to be a little bit sticky, like a sushi rice or something like that, I'll use a little bit less water
than that. I'd love to have a rice cooker for that reason, but the space is an issue.
Yeah.
Have you ever been tempted by the Instapot?
I have been tempted by the Instapot. And I actually, for a brief period of time, I had a Wolfgang Puck branded electric pressure cooker, slow cooker thing. And I tried to make rice in it once. And it
didn't work.
It worked okay, but it didn't actually feel like it saved me that much time. But I think the Instapots are better.
It gets raped. The Instapot, if you haven't heard of it, is a slow cooker, rice cooker,
and pressure cooker
in one.
Yeah.
And I have not personally used one, but I have seen really great reviews.
Yeah, I actually entered a – someone was giving one away recently, and I was like, oh, I'll enter that.
And you lost?
I didn't win.
Bummer.
But no, but I definitely, the rice cooker has been a nice revelation for me.
Do you think you'll continue to use it?
I think so, because the quinoa factor, the farro factor, and then just being able to do sort of hands-off brown rice is kind of nice.
That is great.
Yeah.
I'm jealous.
Well, you can borrow it for a while if you want to play around with it and see. But anyway, yeah. So, and rice is just comforting. Like, for me, this time of year, particularly, I want comforting food. And I know it's not comforting for everyone, but for me, it definitely is.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about food swaps. Tonight is a food swap here in Philadelphia. It will have been long past by the time this episode airs, but that's okay. So we've been food swapping in Philly now for 4 years.
You're one of the founders.
I am. I'm one of the founders of the Philly Food Swap.
Who co-organizes with you?
It is Alexis Siemens, who is one of our guests. Amanda Pfeiffer, who's also been on the podcast. Abby Doyle and Georgia. I'm blanking on her last name. Georgia. I'm sorry, Georgia. Forgive me.
So you've been doing it for 4 years.
We've been doing it for 4 years. The food swap concept started by Kate Payne in Brooklyn maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And we decided that we wanted to bring it to Philly. And it's a fun thing. It's essentially you get a space and you put the call out. It's a free event. And people bring like 8 to 15 individual pieces of a homemade thing. So obviously I'm a canner. I often bring canned goods. This month, I'm bringing homemade kimchi and a veggie soup starter base thing that I make. It's just lots and lots of vegetables pureed together with salt to make sort of a bouillon.
I was the lucky recipient of one of those at a food swap that I went to. And gosh, that stuff is so handy. Do you have a recipe for that on the blog?
I don't. I've been meaning to post it, so I'll get that up soon. But yeah. It's a good one.
It's like truly better than bouillon.
It is really better than bouillon.
And it's from scratch.
It's all real food and it's delicious. And one of the things I love to do is make a quick sort of egg drop soup with it. So I'll put a little in a pot with some boiling water and then whisk up an egg or two and then swirl it in. So it's like this very instant soup.
And it starts with raw vegetables and herbs and salt. Is that the situation?
Yeah, it's like carrots and celery and onions and leeks. Some recipes have you put mushrooms in. I didn't have any this last time, so I didn't.
Dried or fresh?
Fresh.
Okay.
And then, you know, pepper and parsley and then a lot of salt.
Yeah.
And so the salt acts to kind of cure it, preserve it. And so
and I mean also when you buy a commercial bouillon or stock or broth, salt is a very important seasoning.
Exactly.
I don't fear the salt.
No. I feel like most of what I eat I cooked at home, and so the salt is not a big deal. But so yeah, so that's what I'm bringing. And then I'll trade one for one for other people's stuff. So we do have people sign up in advance because often there's a limited number of spots available in the venue we're using. And it has been a really fun sort of community-oriented event for the last 4 years.
What are some of the favorites that you've gotten in as a swap?
Well, lots of people always bring baked goods, which is a nice treat because I don't do a lot of baking. So that's always fun to swap.
Like cupcakes and cookies?
Cupcakes are really, yeah, really good, like chocolate chip cookies. I'm always a fan of swapping for that. Nut butters, homemade nut butters, which is kind of fun. Some people have brought like quarts of soup, homemade soup that you can then just pop in the freezer. I got some great pizza sauce from someone at a food swap once. I really do love swapping for the useful items. Like it's nice to swap for a couple of desserts, but then, you know, get somebody's, you know, loaf of bread, somebody's soup. Another person's eggs, you know, if you have chickens, people bring eggs, amazing.
I didn't get any fresh eggs the time that I went. I did get some great dumplings. Someone made like Asian type dumplings and froze them. And she like brought a cooler packed with ice and
yeah,
they were delicious.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah. I've also gotten, like a hot toddy starter, which was kind of fun.
What's in a hot toddy starter?
It wasn't hot toddy. It was a buttered rum starter. So it was like the buttered, like frozen butter and spices and sugar, and then you put a spoonful in a mug with some water some rum. It was a neat concept. It was very fun around, you know, the holidays.
And for our listeners who might be interested in starting a food swap in their own community, do you have any resources to recommend?
I believe that there is a food swap exchange website. And then there's also on Facebook, there is a Facebook group for food swap leaders. And lots of the different food swap groups have Facebook pages. So if you're curious about finding a food swap in your area, I'd search Facebook first to look to see if there is a food swap community in your neighborhood. Oh, it's the Food Swap Network. So if you look online for the Food Swap Network, I believe that that website's back up. And there's lots of information and resources. Cool. But yeah, it's just a fun event.
Yeah, I wish I could go tonight. Next time.
We are here today with Leanne Brown, the author of Good and Cheap. Leanne is at the very end of a whirlwind 2 months of book touring, and she is sitting down with us at the Free Library of Philadelphia to chat about her book, how it came about, where she's been, and all of the delicious food she's cooked up along the way. So Leanne, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. It's amazing to be here in the Culinary Literacy Center here. I have to say it's very unique. I have been talking at all of my stops about how I'm ending in Philly at this library where they have a full, you know, where they put on full cooking classes in this amazing kitchen.
It's a great kitchen.
It's so exciting.
It's a beautiful space and it's really cool what they're doing here. I'm so glad that
I love it.
You were looking forward to that.
I really was. Oh, and good. It has not disappointed working with the kids earlier. I feel very happy and serene right now.
Oh, good. I'm really glad. So your book, Good and Cheap, has become this massive success out of what was a...
I wouldn't quite say that, but no. I appreciate you saying that.
You won an IACP award. You went from it being your master's project to being a book that is being, you know, was published and sold by Workman. So yeah.
It's been way beyond, for sure, my extremely small-time dreams that I originally had. That's for sure. Yes.
I love it. I love it when life works out that way. So tell us a little bit about how the book got started as the original core of the idea.
Sure. So obviously, you know, it started out as my thesis project. And I think in a way, that's probably why it's a little bit different than so many other things are, is because I was thinking a thesis is this opportunity I may never have again in my life to do something, work on something that I just think should exist.
Yeah.
You know, and here I have this time to pour myself into this thing. And I didn't really know if there was any way to monetize it or anything like that. I wasn't really thinking that way. I was just like, I want this to exist. This is something that during my studies, I realized I am good at and something that I can contribute. And so I wanted to just try that. And so then after I graduated, I initially thought that Good and Cheap would be a really powerful tool in the hands of nonprofits. And that really has turned out to be the case, but I was sort of thinking small scale, like just a couple of the groups that I had worked with already. But nothing was happening quickly enough for me because I'm very impatient. And so I decided to put it online. And then it quickly went viral after someone posted about it on Reddit, which is totally shocking and exciting. And 50,000 people downloaded it in the first night and it broke my website. And it was embarrassing. I got these mean emails of people being like, why can't I get your stuff anymore? And it was really hilarious. But it was also totally exciting because I realized that people really wanted this. And my sort of thinking, which had been very localized, you know, really just thinking, thinking really small, that it was too small scale, that there were a lot of people who wanted this, and that there were hundreds of people saying, Leanne, you know, you need to get this out there.
So the first print run of the book was funded by a Kickstarter. How did that go?
Exactly. Well, it was amazing. So after all the initial excitement, we decided that we needed to get it out there. So we stole the idea from Tom Shoes, the buy one, give one idea, and we asked for $10,000 to fund a print run. We figured we'd do about 500 to our backers and 500 to people who couldn't afford them. And we reached that goal in the first 36 hours.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was crazy. I was so excited and terrified at the same time. And then by the end, we had over $144,000.
Oh my God.
Yeah, which is so much more. And then that allowed, because of the magic of scale in book publishing, we were able to actually print 40,000 books with that money.
Wow.
Which was tremendously exciting, but scary because we live in a tiny apartment and we've never distributed books before. And the whole thing was just like this big, scary problem. But it was amazing. And so we were ultimately able to give 7,000 to our Kickstarter backers, who were from all over the country, which really forced me to think bigger. You know, we were thinking we would work with a couple nonprofits in New York, you know, like I said, some of the people I'd worked with, but we realized that with so many people all across the country supporting the work, we needed to get the books out all over the country as well. So we opened it up to everyone there. And so we sent out 9,000 to nonprofits, we donated them. And then the other scheme we came up with as we were sort of making all this money, and we wanted to get as many out as possible, was that we would sell them to those same nonprofits at cost, so about $4 a book. So the balance, the 24,000, we sold for about $4 a book to all these nonprofits. So we're actually able to get 33,000 out into the hands of people who needed them, which is like beyond exciting.
That's fantastic. And so how did it come to be that you started working with a publisher? Was that part of the Kickstarter process?
No. So that we met during the Kickstarter. As the Kickstarter was doing really well, I heard from a few different publishers. And I was initially kind of skeptical because I thought, here I am like kind of trying to give away books for free. What, like, I don't see how this would make sense. But then Workman said, we want to help you with this project. We want to do it exactly the way you're doing it, but we want to take it further. You know, we want, because at that moment, the book was only available on Kickstarter and on my website. Like, really, you had to know about it in order to get into it. But if I worked with Workman, we could have it available as it is now in every bookstore, you know, on Amazon, like online, everywhere. And for everyone that is sold, we donate one to someone who needs it. And that will be the case for as long as the book is in print.
That's amazing.
Incredible.
That's really exciting. And so for people who don't know, tell us a little bit about what's in the book.
You bet. So I always think of it as a strategy guide more than a cookbook in a lot of ways, because it's not just about, yes, it's a bunch of recipes and I hope that they're very useful, but I don't necessarily expect everyone to like or use every single recipe in the book. Really, I hope that you'll find a few that work well for you and that are very flexible. And so every recipe is extremely flexible. It's sort of a core idea, like I have a crustless quiche, which is basically you caramelize some onions and then you throw, in the book I have it with broccoli, but it can be anything, you know, and I'm imagining people sort of opening their fridge at the end of the week and going like, here's my half a tomato and some other weird stuff that's like in little containers that I might be throwing out, but instead I'm going to throw it into my dish. I'm going to cover it with my lovely eggs and cheese and milk, and we're going to bake it and we're going to have a fabulous quiche at the end of it. And so that's what most of the recipes in the book are like that. They're really, really flexible. It's all about, I have tons of shopping tips, sort of ways to save money and ways to be really efficient. It's all about sort of buying those basic ingredients that are such good workhorses, like, you know, rice and other grains and dried beans and canned tomatoes and eggs, and then supplementing that with seasonal fruits and vegetables so that you can really still have great variety in your diet.
Sounds fantastic. You've been traveling all over.
Yes, it's been crazy. I think as a Canadian coming to the U.S., it's been particularly exciting because there are so many parts of the country I just never thought I would get to that I'm getting to visit now. And I don't really have, I think, as much of a preconceived notion of what a lot of these places are. So it's been very fun.
That's very fun.
I love traveling in the South because I just have never really been around there. Started out the tour in Nashville and oh, it was so interesting.
It is a great part of the country. What kind of events have you done while you've been on the road?
All kinds. So we've done a few library events like this, a lot of little bookstore events, but we've also always tried to do something with a local nonprofit that we're donating books to or that we're working with in some way, because people are doing such interesting things. And sometimes it's a little class, you know, sometimes it's a talk, it's all kinds of things. And then in addition, I'll do, you know, local TV or radio or all that kind of thing. But the part that I find the most like fulfilling and wonderful is just getting to chat with people and hear their stories about sometimes their struggles eating well and sometimes, you know, their really joyful stories about maybe something that's changed in their life that has made life better.
That's really neat. And it is fun when you can actually see how a book you've written is resonating with people and how they're using
it. Oh, it's so great to see. I think food is very powerful. I've always felt that way. That's why I got a food studies degree. That's why I do what I do. But it's so, it sounds so cheesy, but it's so meaningful and validating to actually see how true it is. You know, how powerful simple things can be, like just saying, you know, slow down and eat some cauliflower on toast sometimes. That's a totally legitimate meal. Or, you know, don't worry. Snacks don't have to be these crazy things. They can just be popcorn, which is so inexpensive. You know, how these simple little things can be really empowering and just sort of unleash deliciousness in a lot of people's lives. I know a lot of people have, struggled with making food choices and feeling like they can't eat a lot of the foods that they really enjoy anymore for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to sort of be able to reintroduce the pleasure of food to people as well as, absolutely, of course, the health benefits.
Well, it's no fun. Food can be as healthy, you know, as a cardboard box, but if there's no joy in eating it, then it's not, nobody's going to want to eat it. And so it's got to be delicious and healthy and fun all,
yes,
at once.
Yes. And I think that in some ways there's a lot of messages out there that sort of say that healthy food is boring or is, you know, okay, so it doesn't have GMOs, it doesn't have salt, it doesn't have fat, it doesn't have all these things, but is it good?
Yeah.
And I think we need to remember to talk more about how delicious it is, just so that, you know, the Burger Kings of the world don't spend all their time talking about how delicious it is. And we forget to mention,
yeah,
roasted cauliflower is really delicious.
It is.
It's really crunchy, really crispy, really salty. Oh, it's wonderful.
So this is your last stop on the book tour before you head home. What's next for you? What are you working on after this?
Well, so Workman wants me to do a second book. Uh-huh. And I absolutely will be doing that. I haven't quite decided what it'll be yet. It might be something working more with kids. I really like the idea of doing a really practical kids cooking book. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up with a lot of kids cooking books that were more like, hey, muffins and brownies and things like that. But I want to do something that's a little bit more practical, because I've met a ton of kids who maybe parents or guardians have difficulty. They come home really late and kids maybe don't know how to put something together, and they might want to, whether it's for themselves or actually for parents or guardians when they come home. And I know that kids are dying to help. You know, yeah, they know that people are struggling and they want to be a part of it. And I would love to help empower that a little bit. But you never know. You know, it might be a book. Maybe it's a YouTube series. We'll see. I also want to tell the stories of all the people that I've met on the road and the people who write to me all the time, and talk about, you know, what it's really like to eat on a food stamps budget or just otherwise a very small budget. I think there's a lot of stigma around that. I mean, this is not new information. Of course, there's a lot of stigma around it. And people have a lot of preconceived notions about what a person who is living on very little looks like and acts like and talks like and what their taste is like. And I would love to sort of throw a wrench into that and just show that 46 million Americans who are living on food stamps are just as diverse and interesting and as absolutely everyone else.
I love it. Leanne, I hope that your vision to do more, you know, materializes as soon as possible, because it sounds like you are doing really great work. So congratulations on the book and your success. And
thank you
for being on the podcast with us. And for our listeners out there, that was Leanne Brown, author of Good and Cheap. You can look for the book wherever books are sold. And it's a great guide for eating well and deliciously on $4 a day.
That's right. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Okay, so some of the farmers markets are starting to wind down, but there's still lots of great seasonal produce. Is there anything in particular you're loving this week?
I'm all about the greens right now. How about you?
I also love greens, and I think I love the winter greens even more than summer greens.
Yes, I agree.
They stay good longer in the fridge. I think they have more flavor. They're very versatile. What are some of your favorites?
Well, I'm really enjoying mustard greens, like big, leafy, slightly spicy bundles of mustard greens. They are one of my favorites.
How do you cook them?
I just saute them. And so I like to incorporate them into pots of soup or scrambled into eggs. But also my favorite thing to do with mustard greens is to make whole wheat, like biscuits, essentially. The friend who gave me this recipe called them scones, but my husband is prejudiced against scones, but if you call them biscuits, he'll eat them.
Is it because scones implies like dessert, sugar, sweetness?
I think it's simply that he somehow decided he didn't like scones.
Okay.
But scones and biscuits are cousins, and so I call these just mustard green and cheddar biscuits. There's actually a recipe on my website, but basically you saute the mustard greens, squeeze the water, any liquid out, chop them up, and then you make just these really sort of hearty whole grain biscuits. And instead of using a lot of butter, you bind it with grated cheddar cheese. And so you stir all this together, mold it into biscuit shapes, or, you know, just kind of pat it out and cut it. And they're delicious.
Sounds great.
They're great for sort of breakfasts on the go. And I keep them in the freezer and then just toast them to defrost.
Yum. I like mustard greens that like stir-fried Asian style.
Yeah, that's good too.
Maybe with a little dried ham or definitely with sesame oil and chilies, garlic, ginger, scallion. That's usually my method for those. I think one of my favorites in the winter is mustard greens, which are also not mustard greens. Collard greens.
Oh, there we go.
I like to wrap things in a collard green, like a little – like a wrap, like a burger or other sandwich fillings. It's a spread or seeds or sprouts. Do you use them that way?
I don't use them that way a lot. I love just cooking, sort of simmering and sautéing collard greens, not to the point that sort of that traditional
– I was going
to
say Southern style.
Not Southern style so much as just – I like them to have a little bit of bite still, but I cut them into really fine ribbons and sauté them with maybe some peppers and and then eat them on top of some sort of grain, like our rice that we were talking about earlier, or quinoa or something. And it makes a really sort of hearty, nice meal. And you get, because they're so sturdy, you get sort of a meatiness from them.
Yeah.
Like,
where do you stand on escarole?
I like it in soup. Or recently, I've started making this beans and greens thing that I wrote about. We talked about that.
We did talk about that. And I just want to let you know, one of my friends who is – she does cook at home, but not like – she's not like a hardcore home cook like we are. But she tried the recipe that we linked to, and she loved it.
Hooray!
Shout out to Audrey. I'm so glad you tried it.
That's awesome. But so escarole, curly endive, those work so well in that kind of sautéed beans and greens treatment. And so – and then also, you know, they're just traditional in a pot of like meatballs, little meatball soup.
I love escarole because it's bitter. I like all things aggressively bitter. And I like it raw in a salad. I sometimes do an escarole salad with a sweet pickled onion, and it's just one of my favorite things.
That sounds really good.
I do like it in soups too, but it's one of my favorites. It's so great with like any kind of a fatty pork thing.
Yeah.
I do just love it in salad. I got some of my final CSA box last week, and I can't wait to eat it. It's probably going to be on the table tonight in a salad.
Sounds so good. All right. Well, I think that's it for this week of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show and to Raina Rose for providing the music. We also thank Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo. And we thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Local Mouthful, as well as on Facebook. You can also sign up for our newsletter and catch up on all of our episodes and show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.